Here at Early Excellence, we specialise in early childhood education. We offer expert advice and guidance through training, consultancy and classroom design. With the Early Excellence podcast, we aim to inspire and support you as well as challenge your thinking. So if that's what you're looking for, you've come to the right place. Hello everybody, Andy Burt here. Welcome along to episode 193 of the Early Excellence podcast. In this week's episode, we chat to Charlotte and Rob from Wellington College in China. And we talk about all sorts of things. We discuss their bilingual and immersive curriculum. We talk about project-based learning. We talk about the characteristics of effective learning right at the heart of all of that, of course, as well, and lots more besides. So here you go. Here's my Early Excellence podcast chat with Charlotte and Rob from Wellington College in China. Hello to both of you.
Hello. Hello. Thank you for having us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. It's great that you could join us. Now, the way that this came about was that Rob got in touch with us and was talking about, in an email to me actually, talking about lots of exciting things that you do over there at Wellington College. And so, and it really interesting, the sorts of things that you were keen to talk about around an immersive curriculum, around a bilingual curriculum as well, really interesting aspects. And we're going to get into all of that. Before we do, I thought we'd have some introductions, if that's all right. Should we start with you, Charlotte, if that's okay?
Absolutely. Thank you. I'm Charlotte Knight-Bengerfield. This is, my goodness, it's my eighth year in China. Like many people, I came over for 2 years and ended up staying for way longer. So I've got the badge of honor of having been through two COVIDs here in China and lived to tell the tale. So I'm very lucky. I've been a head of early years and now I'm a principal of early years in our EYC campus here in Shanghai, which looks after the children from the international school, which you've mentioned is Wellington College, but also our bilingual arm of the school, which is called our Heba Nursery. So I'm very lucky to have the opportunity to lead both and all of that that's involved in that. So yeah, really lovely to be here today and share some ideas.
Brilliant.
Yeah, very much. My name's Rob Spillane. I'm one of the assistant heads in the EYC, the Early Years Campus. My particular focus is curriculum and assessment. But I've been working here for, I think this is my eighth year as well. But I think I've really settled down into the Shanghai. I'm married now. So yeah, I think this is my future. Certainly, I'm really enjoying my time in China.
No, brilliant. And certainly from when I've spoken to you both before, you can tell you really enjoy it. You know, we had a chat, didn't we, a couple of weeks ago, and there's a real spark there, a real fascination in that early years practice and absolutely getting it right. And I was really impressed with the detail to which you really, really discussed it and that spark behind it, both from a kind of a practical point of view, but also from a leadership point of view as well. I think that really is powerful stuff. And we're going to get into that. So, from my point of view, I always find it easiest to talk about it at kind of chronologically as a bit of a journey. And people who listen to the podcast a lot will kind of laugh at this because it always feels like every time I talk to somebody from a school or setting, we kind of get into early on, we get into that idea of it being a journey and the timings of it. So I'm interested to know, we're going to talk about the exciting and interesting, fascinating things that you do in terms of your curriculum, but I'm interested to know the starting points for it. So when did this start? Is there a beginning of the journey? Is there a spark to that beginning?
I think it's worth mentioning that 8 years ago when Rob and I came to China, this was a very interesting time in education in China. Many people in the UK may have a particular view. I know media reports have a certain way of portraying things, but I will say about the Chinese government, they really decided to take a fresh look at early years education. And I think many teachers out there would be really surprised to know how similar the Chinese kindergarten curriculum, the framework, is to our early years foundation stage curriculum. And as a leader and a practitioner and a teacher here, I was really pleasantly surprised at how child-centered it was and how skills-based it was and skills-focused. I came with misconceptions that perhaps it would be lots of rote learning, kind of old school, children sat in rows, but it was very far from it. But nevertheless, the schools that I've worked in particular in Wellington and Heber, we have been on a journey. We've definitely come along the journey of being very mindful of this being child-centered, being yeah. very mindful that we want to develop children who are intrinsically motivated, excited to learn. And so I've been very lucky to work with Rob and the team here in evolving that kind of curriculum. So we started off about 3 years ago when we started in earnest, where we decided we needed to really articulate this in a meaningful way. Because it's all very well doing it in practice, but if it's not written down anywhere and it's not repeatable or articulatable, how do we share that meaningfully with teachers and practitioners and parents? So that is when we wrote our curriculum charter, which we are going to talk more on, I think, later in this podcast. And that's where we really decided to nail our colours to the mast, as it were. What do we really stand for? What do we really want for our children? And what are the experiences of learning going to be like? What's it going to look like, feel like, smell like? I mean, it's a sensory experience. It's a social experience. So that was where it all began, I think. And Rob's been part of that curriculum development team from the very beginning.
Yeah. And I think it's making sure that you know, we're far away from the UK, but we work in a British school. So actually needing to have that connection with the UK is really important for us as educators, but it's really important for our parents as well. Our parents, they look at that education and that's what they want for their children. They want that really experiential learning that stems from quality practice in the UK. And so we're listening to the community around us and making sure that our education that we're offering really speaks to all stakeholders, whether that be teachers, leaders, parents, families. We call them families because it's not just the child. We actually want to bring every member of that family along a journey when we're developing a curriculum or when we're developing our educational philosophy. And so, talking about our curriculum charter was really our pin in the map to sort of say, this is what we do. This is what we believe in, and these are our next steps. And it really helped us develop that sort of roadmap for us to follow.
For any school, that's key, isn't it? You know, that idea of being able to have a clear message, a clear vision, being able to communicate that easily and succinctly with everybody who's involved, whether that be your staff within the classroom, whether that be parents, whether that be other leaders. Being able to manage that process is key, because otherwise it just doesn't get off the ground at all, does it?
Absolutely. And in fact, when we decided to write the charter, the first place we went to was to the UK. We took a sample across many excellent primary schools and early year settings across the UK about how they were articulating their curriculum. We thought, this is not the time to reinvent the wheel. Let's look at how others are doing it. And we were able to cast our net wide. And that was a brilliant starting point for us. So we were very clear we wanted to articulate the intent, the implementation and the impact of the curriculum in a way that was sort of discussable, transferable and meaningful to all of our parents, but also to colleagues at our sister school in the UK, so that we can actually share best practice. Because as we all know, curriculum is a living, breathing thing. It's all very well writing it down, but you've got to be able to talk about best practice and what that looks and feels like. So we really wanted to make sure that we were aligned, if you like, in how we were, the language we were using and the framework that we were using to explain what we were doing.
Absolutely. I think the other thing that I think comes across really clearly from what you're saying is that through doing your research, you know, from coming over to the UK, from seeing lots of really effective practice, that what you've put together in terms of the charter at that point is partly about what you want the children to learn, but also, and probably as if not more importantly, how you want them to learn. So, and the attributes and the characteristics of effective learning that underpin all of that. Am I right? I mean, I'm kind of putting words into your mouth, but I'm assuming that's right. It certainly seems like it from what you're saying.
Yeah, every practitioner within our school community really believes in the characteristics of effective learning. We understand that they underpin high quality practice. They underpin learning. And it's something we assess within our setting. You know, we assess characteristics of effective learning and whether the children are able to utilize those skills in order to access what they're learning within the classrooms, within the learning space. We have amazing learning spaces here, but learning spaces are not useful to you as a tool without practitioners able to understand how to prepare them for high quality learning and set them up for children. So having really clear outlines from the leadership roles above are really important for teachers to be able to follow that journey. And it's no good Charlie as the principal saying, oh, I want you to do this, go do this, ABC. Okay, off you go, bye-bye. That's not how it works in a high-performing school, in a high-performing team. Charlie, as the principal, is very much part of that journey. And everyone on that journey has a voice in the way things are implemented, the way that things work together. It's really important to make sure that, you know, we're a community and we build things as a community. Because when, as an international school, things change quite frequently. We can have some teachers will leave after a couple of years. Some will stay for 10 years. I've worked in this company for 8 years. My colleagues have worked here since the school opened. So you've got potential changing dynamics. So having really concrete foundations is so important.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, as I mentioned, your original email, you talked to me about the fact that you'd got a bilingual immersive curriculum there. Okay. And so what I thought I would do, as there's kind of two strands there, is look at those two things separately. I know that actually they're probably so interlinked within your curriculum that it's hard to separate them out. But given that many, many, many of our listeners will be based within the UK, I wanted to have a think about and discuss the bilingual strand of what you mentioned. What does that look like? You know, because in many of our schools, although we will have, of course, children with English as an additional language, I gain from what you're talking about and what you've talked about to me before that this is a step on from just supporting those individual children, that this is more of a culture. Is that right?
That's a good way of putting it. I really like that. I think it's worth commenting that when I was a practitioner in the UK, the last year I taught in the UK, I had 7 languages within my classroom in reception. And we're in a way, find it a little easier in many respects, because we are really catering to 2 languages, to Chinese and to English. So all children that join us can speak either one of those languages. We aim by the end of their journey for them to have a sort of bilingual literacy, if you like, an ability to be bilingual learners by the end of the journey. But they can either speak Chinese or English or both when they join us. Mm-hmm. So that is our commitment to our parents. The vast majority of our pupils are Chinese first language speakers. So mostly they join us being, you know, an age-appropriate level of language for their age. So parents are really concerned about that first language also being supported and developed, as well as them learning English as that second or additional language. So we've got to be really intentional about teaching language, as well as offering opportunities for that to naturally evolve. So we've got to really think about what does bilingual learning look like. And the reason why immersive really links to that is that we choose the approach of project-based learning, which is a fully immersive, authentic experience for children, if you like, to be the key and primary motivator for them to engage both of their languages in their listening, understanding, and in speaking. So that's how it begins. We do support children who are coming in speaking Chinese, and we obviously develop that vocabulary and that thinking and that high order thinking. And we have key milestones, as you would expect, like we do in YFS. Very similar, actually. They reflect in our framework. They very much reflect the milestones that you would see for English communication and language, and support children step by step through inspiring hooks, as we call them, as we develop then projects with them where children are motivated to find out more. And some of the language and the vocabulary that children are using is really quite phenomenal. I mean, we were very, very lucky that we invited Greg Bottrell to our school from the UK, many of our UK listeners who will know and have met Greg, and I'm sure have had Greg in their school. And he was quite inspirational for us in developing that exciting portal into stories, as he would call it. And really, you know, we know stories are so interesting and exciting for children, so that they've got that real motivation, that they really want to find out more. And that oracy is really at the heart of this. So really thinking about how we support role modeling oracy, but also opportunities and motivation for oracy.
Yeah, I think I'm glad Charlie mentioned oracy there, because for us, you know, we've got children who are second language speakers. So quite a high percentage of my children are not, when they start, are not at the same level as an English speaking child in the UK. You wouldn't expect it to be. So it takes a lot of work and a lot of time and a lot of effort from teachers to surround those children with language that we want them to learn, i.e. English, in a context where English is not the dominating language. So I've done so much research when I was in the classroom trying to find strategies to help develop English language. But it was so difficult to find, because everything was designed for an EAL child in the UK. And so it's actually really difficult to find anything of an EAL child in their native country.
A different twist on it, isn't it?
That's it. And you've got to be really creative as a teacher in drawing that language out. And I guess building on that oracy, it's not just getting them to speak. It's about, what are they speaking about? What is oracy? It's actually developing the ability to talk about something. And it's not just, you know, jumper, hat, tie, coat. That language is very basic. By the time they leave our nursery, we want them to be able to speak about a project they've done. We want them to be able to have done some individual research, and for them to explain their thinking and explain their research and explain their work to some length, to the same. And we're aspirational. We're a very aspirational nursery. We want them to be doing it the same level as an English speaking child in the UK. And that's what we're constantly trying to work on, and developing that language in a bilingual setting, because we want them to do it in Chinese and English.
Yes. Aspirational, isn't it? What struck me as well from what you were saying is that you're also talking about the context, aren't you? And the context is key. You're not talking about teaching those children a different language through necessarily sort of flashcards or something that's quite abstract. You're talking about using a model which we're going to come to, that immersive project-based approach, where presumably you find something that fascinates the children, that interests those children, and it's that that is the hook to developing the communication and language skills, and of course learning a new language. Is that right? You know, it sounds like it's very much within the context of that approach.
Absolutely, and you're quite right. How do we even begin? So practically speaking, we use those amazing observation skills that our practitioners have. So we've got a really rich environment, and there may be a few interesting provocations or hooks in the learning environment. So we use that opportunity to observe children, again, very much with COEL at the heart of what we're observing. How are they approaching? How are they learning? What are we getting from that? And then we then have discussions with our teachers, or our teachers have a co-teaching model. So we have one English-speaking teacher and one Chinese-speaking teacher within the classroom environment. And they use their observation skills to then develop either a problem to solve, a question, or a big theme to follow. And that's where the discussion begins. And I do want to be really clear and intentional that pupil voice is critical at this point. So what we try and do is, I mean, we've all been there as teachers. I'm the first to hold my hand up, where you can really guide it through and, oh, look at this amazing project, and you've basically already decided.
But we know where it's going.
Hard. Yeah, I'm being very honest. We try very hard not to do that. We genuinely want to throw out those conversations, those questions, those ideas. And we've been quite pleasantly surprised a number of times at the the nuances and the questions and the ideas that these children are coming up with. And it takes us on that journey of learning together. And you talked a little bit earlier about the impact on staff for that. That's why our staff are so passionate and inspired, because they're kind of going on a journey together, holding hands with their pupils, finding out together and asking those questions and those nuances. So it really is quite magic. I always end up sounding very early years at this point, because but it is just something magical.
But it is though, isn't it?
Within the classroom environment, it's like that spark of what do we already know and what we're trying to find out here and why. Because otherwise we can end up on this journey of finding out and questioning and questioning and questioning. And I think we've again all been there when this idea of really developing a dialogue with our pupils ends up being a bombardment of questions.
Yeah, it ends up being one-sided, doesn't it?
Yeah, being really thoughtful about how we are evolving the pupil voice so that they have ownership of their learning. And that's something I know Rob feels very passionately about and works very closely with actually the practitioners in the classroom.
Yeah. Shall we move on to that? Shall we get on to that? Because we've talked around it, but let's get into the sort of the nitty gritty of what does that project based immersive approach look like? So, you know, in terms of within the classroom, Rob, what would you see? What sorts of experiences are you seeing? Paint us a picture of it, if you could.
Yeah. Well, do you know what? So I was previously a teacher before I became assistant head. I was in the classroom.
Yes.
And so I get sort of from experience, I think, to start off, not to scare anybody, bilingual teaching is one of the hardest methods of teaching I've ever experienced, because I was 50% of the teaching team and I had someone else who didn't speak my language as their first language. I'm fortunate. I work with incredibly skilled practitioners who are bilingual themselves. But we also have different ideas of what teaching looks like from our childhoods, from our training. And so actually, it's quite a dance that you have to do with your co-teacher as you're developing these ideas in the classroom. You have to be so in sync. And I've had teachers that I got on really well with, teachers that we had slightly different ideas. And I'm lucky that from when I was previously in the classroom, in my last 2 years, I got on, I had a really fantastic relationship with my co-teacher. And we understood each other's skills. And that helped us build a really fantastic project, because it's like you're bouncing ideas off somebody. And so if you're coming up with a project, I've got an idea in my head about what I think is going to be a really interesting project. But that is no good if the children don't care about it. Yeah. So I can do, and I've tried that. I've thrown so much spaghetti at the wall to see if it sticks, and it never does. However much I want to do Little Red Riding Hood because I think it's going to be fantastic to do a performance at the end, they were not interested in Little Red Riding Hood. And so it had to be, nope, sorry, that's not an idea. And that's where provocations are really important. So the start of a project, I'm getting an idea. I know that we call them KDIs. I know the statements that and the learning intentions that I want the children to be able to do by the end of the year, because that's what we're assessing against.
Yeah, but that's what we're here for. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, I've got to teach them something. I'm not just, it's not about, play-based learning is not just about playing and watching. I actually have to be intentional. I do have to do some teaching sometimes, or certainly I can set things up so that learning can happen in the environment. And we talk about that. Environment is your third teacher. And to be honest, it's one of the strongest teachers in the classroom is the classroom. So I'm setting up a project and I've got some ideas in my head and I've got some intentions of things that I want them to learn. So I'm going to set out some provocations. So one that I did previously was about, we were going to looking at recycling. And so I actually had a shark and a little toy shark, and I cut its fins and I used a little bit of red paint and I bought a big fishing net and I put it in and I got all these fish and I got them really tangled in that fishing net and I got some rubbish in there and I got it all mixed up in this huge, you know, professional real life fishing net, because as we all know, it's really important you use real life objects. I couldn't have a real shark though. That was important. Don't use a real shark. So we set it all up and then the children came in and they're like, oh my goodness, Mr. Rob, what's this? And I'm like, oh my, oh my goodness, what is it? What's happened? And I'm allowing them to investigate. And I'm asking them questions, and I'm getting their thoughts, I'm getting their ideas. And that's where I'm gauging their interest. And this is all happening bilingually. So my coach is listening for these questions, just as I'm listening for the questions. But obviously I'm speaking in English. She was speaking in Chinese. And it's really important that we're then connecting, because what we're going to do later on that day, we're going to meet and we're going to say, right, tell me what they said. Let me write it down. Let me come up with some ideas. Tell me what they said, and I'll tell you what they said. And what does that mean? And then we're going to start working out, right, what does that mean we do tomorrow? What does that mean we do on Wednesday? What does that mean we do next week? And then gathering all of those ideas, we're gathering questions, we're gathering knowledge. Because if we start a project without gathering knowledge, we don't know what we're teaching. Because it's no point in me teaching something they already know. And that assessment is really important at the beginning of a project. So gauge what they know, and then give your provocations that hopefully you'll get some questions. And now it's time to investigate. And then that's when you can start investigating. You can start answering these questions that the children had. Again, letting them drive that project. And I'm facilitating it. I'm really a facilitator at that point. I'm making sure that I'm giving them inspiration. So I'm introducing stories. Shark in the Park was a really popular one at that time.
I bet. Great story. Yeah.
That gave me sort of into doing some literacy. So we're making some books about Shark in the Park as well. And then obviously I've put some rubbish and we couldn't keep the net up the whole time because it took up half my classroom. But we can use some of those artifacts and make a little display that we can keep referring back to. And I'm writing down some of the questions. We're using, what are they called? Sound buttons. We're using sound buttons to get the children to use their speaking, because that's my intention as the English teacher. I need them to speak. I need them to, as a tool for my assessment, to check whether they can actually ask questions. And that's important, whether it's in their home language or whether it's in their second language. And sort of gathering all this evidence. And then that's giving me a tool to pursue this project. Once I've got them in and I can tell they're really invested, I can then move on. And I can offer them some more learning, and I can take it in whichever direction it needs to go.
Yes. And presumably as well, you've got an idea of those hooks, you know, those provocations through your relationships with the children before you place that in. So your relationships with the children within what's always there, that it's not just about the provocation, that actually the provocation sits on top of what is already a high quality learning environment, that actually you've got all sorts of different things that are working clearly there. And then your relationships on top of that, and then you have an inkling as to what's going to work. The reason that I'm asking about that is that I think there's sometimes a danger that the provocations, which are the eye-grabbing things and are great, and clearly they are, you know, clearly from what you've described, that's brilliant. But there is, I'm just thinking about the danger of sort of like, almost like that sort of Pinterest type approach where somebody just feels like they've got to have loads of amazing provocations everywhere. That's not quite, it is the starting point of this project, isn't it? But it's not the starting point of the practice. The practice is based on a high quality learning environment that's always there. And also, of course, your staff interactions and engagement with the children within that space. Does that make sense?
Yeah. A Pinterest display is great, but if it doesn't serve a purpose and it's not linked to anything and it's not an interest, it's just a nice display. And as soon as the children touch it, they're not going to know what to do with it. And it's just going to be a bit of a mess on the table.
It's also worth thinking about what you're saying there, Andy. It's also worth emphasizing the rigor that goes on behind the scenes. And this is where I do want to jump in. It all sounds great. And I think
it is great.
I think you're saying it is great. It absolutely is. And children are very engaged. But you're absolutely right. Without the rigor behind it and the thoughtful, meaningful discussions and communication and observations of children and discussions with staff, then it can run the risk of becoming this sort of almost like a children's entertainment. Oh, this is nice. Let's do another provocation. And I think in order to move away from that, which I have seen happen, is there does need to be some discussion behind the scenes about the evolution of skills on this journey. So the curriculum map that happens behind the scenes is like the, if you like, the guiding map. It's not about the content so much, because we can definitely follow the interests of children there. Although we do also have to be really clear about it being high quality content. Otherwise, let's face it, there would have been the time when every project would have just been about Frozen. So we've got to be really clear about what is it we say is meaningful learning here in this high quality environment. So the curriculum map that sits behind it, that is evolved with the team during their planning meetings, and obviously is a living, breathing, working document. But you mentioned, you know, what about the text? What about those high quality ideas? What about some of the songs we want to implement? What about the skills? What about the learning intentions? And those are all on the map, and they get woven in whichever direction this interesting and exciting project takes. The curriculum app is the other roots. They hold it, everybody. And they keep the rigor and the, and if in my case, what's really important, I know the quality is there.
We
work really hard with our year group leaders, are the owners of the curriculum maps. They work with their teachers and they evolve them in planning meetings every week. And the planning meetings, therefore, become really, really critical. Because otherwise, again, what you end up doing is having this environment that's refreshed every day with lovely, new, shiny, interesting provocations. And let's be honest, children will respond really well to that. That is one thing that on the surface level, it can look like it's really effective. But what we're interested in is the journey and the deeper learning, which is where the characteristics of effective learning are really critical. So as part of the observation cycle, as we take the journey with the children, our practitioners are really looking at that, looking for that deeper level engagement from pupils, from children who are taking that, what we're offering them, and getting that deeper learning and going into that zone of proximal development. So they're really able to stretch and build on that learning. And that's the sweet spot we're looking for. But without that rigor, if it happened, we'd miss it. So the rigor needs to be there.
Of course. In order
to be the facilitator.
Yeah, it goes hand in hand, doesn't it? It absolutely goes hand in hand. And that's what I think comes across really loud and clear. And it's great to talk to both of you together, is that actually you get this idea of the practice, which is absolutely exciting and engaging, but also actually what goes behind it is that it isn't just a provocation that, you know, you could just come up with. It actually has all sorts of thinking behind it, of course, and it's built on the really strong foundations in terms of your overall environment, the overall learning environment, and the emotional environment, which is your staff engaging with the children, and that it's a spark, but it's not just, it's not based. There is a danger sometimes with practice that there's a spark, which is a provocation, but it's not really based on anything. Whereas I get the impression from talking to both of you that actually it absolutely is. There's a solid foundation there in terms of the practice and the planning for it, I think.
Absolutely. And what we're trying to avoid is, I think, what we can all recognise has happened to us at various points as teachers, where it just becomes a string of activities and tasks.
Exactly.
It's similar. I think you're saying the same thing. It's very easy to fall into the trap as a practitioner. That's a good activity. We did that last year when we did space. Let's do that again.
Yeah, and that's what we're trying to do. Last year, let's do it again. Yeah.
So that's what the listeners might say, well, what's the point in doing a project when I've got perfectly good topics in my school and I've got my space? I'm going to use space as my example because I did like space. But you've got your bank of resources and your activities, and every year you wheel them out and it's pretty similar. So what we're trying to say is, yes, that's okay. But if you want to elevate learning, if you really want to engage with pupil voice in its most authentic way, we've got to think about learning in a different way. We've got to be prepared for the unexpected and the unplanned for, and the fact that we're not going to wheel out that task again because we happen to like doing that task. We're going to really think about what questions are children asking about? What are they showing interest in? How are we observing that? And how are we shaping the next steps? And how is the environment supporting us to do that? And I think that's worth mentioning, because I know as a teacher myself, that was always my tension, you know, about not wanting to keep wheeling out those same tasks year on year and being really meaningful and thoughtful and authentic about what we do.
Yes, absolutely. It's not about clinging to something that you know exactly where it's going. in terms of a topic, is it? It's about actually having, to a certain extent, the flexibility, the confidence as well, to be able to start off with something and not really know exactly where it's going. And that, you know, you might start off with a provocation, but you really don't know where it will be, you know, where it's going to go in a week's time, 2 weeks' time. You might have an idea, but actually it will be the children's ideas and the thoughts of the children that will shape it. Is that right? I mean, going back to Rob, in terms of the practice, what does that process look like?
It takes a brave leader to allow the teachers to have what feels like an unplanned future. I think, you know, from being in the UK, I knew what I was teaching next in January. I knew what I was doing in April because it was going to come round again. And that is fantastic. And it has its place in certain schools, but to have the opportunity to have freedom in your educational journey is quite scary for teachers. When you first join our school, people sort of ask and they'll say, oh, have you got the work? Have you got the thing you did last year? And we're like, no. Like, well, what do you want? Have you asked your children? And we'll always say, go back to your children. Go and ask your children. Because that's what it's about. We are there for our children. We're there for the pupils. Yes, I like football. I could teach you the World Cup. I really enjoy the World Cup. I really enjoy football. I can link it to maths. I can link it to all my areas of learning. But if my children aren't going to care about it, then who am I catering for as a practitioner, as a teacher?
Who's that for? Yeah.
Yeah. So it's really important.
Do you know what I really want you to share, Rob? I really want you to share one of our early projects. When we started our journey on project-based learning, it was, this is our third year. And it has its teething along the way. But one of the projects which really sticks in my mind is the Heber Hotel project, which happened in EY3, which is reception age.
Yes.
It was only by observing children coming back from their travels, because obviously here we are in Asia and many of our children get to travel all over the world. And they were coming back with their stories about the fantastic hotels they'd been in and what they'd been doing. Our teachers noticed this and took the opportunity to talk about, okay, well, how about we open our own hotel here? And we have got some lovely learning spaces. So we evolved and developed this idea with our children over a number of weeks. I'm going to steal Rob's thunder. How did that work, Rob? Would you like to share that with us? Because I think by a real example, you can get the heart of it and the excitement of it.
Yeah, because I'm keen for people to really have a picture of what this project-based learning looks like. You know, what would you see? How does it unfold?
Well, it's making it real life. So the children are interested in hotels and they have this idea. So they're role-playing what it's like to be in a hotel. So what is the best way other than to go and visit a hotel? Lots of school trips will go to the zoo. Lots of school trips will go to, you know, a museum. But actually the interest of the children was to go to a real life hotel. So we went to a real life hotel and the children were the workers in the hotel and they would go and learn how to prepare the rooms, prepare the beds, do the cleaning. And they took their parents as well, because we were lucky that we get to take our parents on the school trips as well. So they go and experience these jobs in the hotel. And that's building on their interest. It's building on their previous knowledge. And then they're learning those new skills. They're applying their ideas and they're coming back and learning it. And then we said, okay, so now you know how to do a hotel. Now you know how to be in a hotel. What's the next step? The next step is you want to create your own hotel. Okay, then how do we create our own hotel? What's the first thing we need to do? Oh, well, first we need to come up with a name of our hotel. Okay, what do we want to call the name of the hotel? And then you'll do voting, you'll do sort of different activities, you'll do some advertisements. And so you'll bring in some literacy there. And then you then start to involve your community. Well, do we have any experts? So we invite the experts in. The experts who work in hotels, let us interview you, let us ask you questions. So we're turning learning into real life, and we're actually bringing it into the nursery and bringing it into the life. So we're no longer in maths class. We're actually just speaking to the receptionist of a nursery, and we're learning how much a hotel should cost and what we need to do in that payment process. So it's really giving the children real life examples and real life experiences of that hotel. And yeah, it eventually ended up, we opened Heba Hotel. And we invited lots of special guests to the opening of Heba Hotel, and they could come and experience being in that hotel. And so it means completely changing the classroom. It's no longer a classroom. It is now a hotel. And it was a really, really special experience for those children to feel ownership of their learning. Real ownership, real development was visible in that process of following through. And we'd call that our phase three of the project. We'd call that our celebration of the project, is actually going, so these are all the things I've learned, and this is how it's manifested, and this is what it looks like at the end.
Mm. Yes.
I love
Brilliant.
That project. So I got to cut the ribbon, Andy. I was the VIP who opened it. And it, you know what really struck me was the joy in the children's face. When they got to this stage where they could invite me to come along with my big scissors, you know, and snip that ribbon and to celebrate with them what they'd achieved. By the way, we're not expecting a specific outcome here. It is worth highlighting this point.
Yes.
Some of the things they designed were quite radical. You know, they'd got, you know, pet bedrooms and all sorts of weird and wonderful things happening in their restaurant. You know, it was quite innovative and interesting how they used IT. They were very keen to involve QR codes because they're a big part of real life here in China. So children very rarely see real money, but QR codes were there. And, you know, there was a reception that they'd evolved, but the QR code was very prominent there. Mm. And it wasn't, so it was a, it was definitely an imaginary hotel, but to these children, it was a very real hotel. So they bought, you know, their dolls and their toys and their pets to come to this hotel. And they also wanted to introduce their parents to it. And it was just really interesting to see how they then articulated what they'd learned and showcased that. That, to me, is really important part of the learning cycle. I think it's something we don't do enough, or the celebrations are not authentic. So, yes. You know, the idea of praise, 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 it becomes quite meaningless. They'd been on quite a journey. Some of the ideas that some of them had come up with, the designs, the research, they'd been quite frustrated at times and hadn't always managed to make things work. Signs fell down, things didn't quite work. And they had to solve these problems that happened along the way of this design. And so, you know, we didn't even have to create, if you like, these problems to solve because they were real. And it was quite interesting. We all learned a lot. It was a very early project for us. And we used that with hindsight. It was like a pivotal moment for us all in our journey of learning about what we really wanted a high quality project to look and feel like. And it was a really good example of it. And in fact, myself, Rob, and my head of early years here at the school, we often speak at conferences. And this is one example I bring up time and time again, because it's one that's really rich because it shows us how, by making it authentic, all the learning was right there in the evolution of how this worked. So this project, again, we didn't get to one day and go, right, that's it, then everybody moving on. It kind of, we allow, because we have got some lovely space here, the hotel carried on running for quite some time, and a new project evolved alongside it and then overtook it. So we were quite happy with the overlap, and that's something you can think about. So many teachers out there listening might say, well, that sounds like a giant role play to me. Yeah. And in some respects, it is. And that's if I were to simplify it down, if I were to distill it down to something really important, I'd say that's actually really, in its simplest form, that's what it is. It's a giant role play, but we get into it and it becomes real to us in its evolution. And so don't be scared of making your classroom a giant role play. I think it's one of the most valuable things I've ever done as a teacher. My role play grew and grew and grew one year till it was almost the entire classroom. And it was one of the richest learning experiences the children ever had. So I would say be brave and be prepared to let this become the learning, become the space for learning.
It's certainly about being brave, isn't it? Definitely. I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier on, that what I'm very aware of is that in order to have that sort of approach where you are giving, maybe having a starting point, a hook, if you like, but then having the flexibility and the freedom to then go elsewhere with it that isn't absolutely mapped out and planned to the hilt, where you know exactly what you're doing in week 7 of the project and all of that kind of thing, but that actually you're prepared to run with it and go in different directions. That obviously asks a lot of the staff, and you have to have very special staff to be able to do it. And I wondered whether you could talk a bit about that. What sorts of qualities do your staff have to enable that project-based approach to work?
Goodness, what a brilliant question, Andy. I think because it's my job to recruit these brilliant teachers. So, and TAs. I mean, goodness me, where would we be without our amazing teaching assistants? I would say there has to be a real open-mindedness and a curiosity. I'm going to say competency, absolutely a given. I believe that the best teachers within a project-based learning environment are highly, highly capable and competent, and they understand their framework really well. That's a given. But in terms of aptitudes, I would say curiosity, open-mindedness, and able to take those risks, and almost be a little, have a bit of the magic of being a bit childlike themselves, in that in order to learn alongside children, you have to almost be able to sit back and be one of them, swim with the shoal.
Yeah, yeah.
What I mean?
Yeah, no, definitely. It's that entering into their world kind of idea, isn't it?
Their world, not our world. Over you go, Rob. I can feel desperate to say.
It's still remaining objective as a teacher. You are still there as an educator. So I think that, and that's the real difficult skill, is because I can get in there with the children and I can run and I can play and I can be such fun. But actually, this is still a learning moment. This is everything's a learning moment. I still have to be objective and be able to take a step back and say, what is my intention? And I think having teachers that everything is intentional, everything is a choice that we want to make sure that we're pushing our children to be the best that they can be. And that's really important. You know, we know that the difference between a child born in September and a child born in August is one whole year, but they might be in the same year group. And I think teachers having that ability to know what that means and how they can still challenge all of those children in that class and how they can really build them up to be fantastic learners, because that's what we're wanting to create, is lifelong learners.
Yes,
we want to have high outcomes and all of those amazing things. But when you've got objective teachers who can work on that, we're very lucky. It all falls into place for us here.
Yes, yes. But it's what's key, I think, and what comes across from what you're saying is that there is a sort of emotionally, there are different things happening. There's an emotional bond, I think, between the adults and the children in terms of them being together, holding hands as they join, maybe not physically, but actually it feels like they are holding hands and going along and learning together. But also that through doing that, this is a positive experience for the children. They are feeling positive about it, that this is something that they're interested in. And whether they, you know, in years to come, in 10 or 15 or 20 years time, whether they remember the specifics of what they learned or not is one thing or another. But they will certainly remember how they felt when they were 3 or 4 or 5, won't they? They'll remember that feeling of learning was fascinating and learning is fascinating. And that, you're right, that is about lifelong learning. Whether they remember the specifics or not, you've put in place something which I think is powerful, that is that you're building something. The starting point's a strong foundation for these children as lifelong learners.
Agree. And I think there's a relationship there that we must not forget to talk about in all of this, which is that relationship between pupils, that peer learning.
And yes,
our teachers, I have noticed in the years I've been here, are really skilled at that. As I was listening to you, Rob, talking, I was reminded of Julie Fisher and about, you know, making sure we're not interfering too much.
Yeah.
And that again is you were talking about intention. It's not always about what we do, it's also what we don't do and the decisions that we're making. To again, that's kind of what I meant by being able to let children really genuinely take the driving seat. Step back, because where are we going to go with this? How amazing and how exciting and joyful, and being really, really wanting that for them, because we know what that means and how precious that is. Going on that journey as facilitators, so that we're supporting peer learning as well. Being really intentional sometimes about our groupings of children. So, you know, rather than moving away from that task-based, activity-based, outcomes-focused, we're thinking about, well, it's the journey. I sound like a bank advert now, but it's the journey that matters. But, and it really is. And we, you know, we're giving these great opportunities and we're facilitating, but we're not trying to be too dominant in the process of learning. And I think that way it does give children the opportunity to make mistakes. It does give the children the opportunity for the choices not always to go well, to resolve conflicts, to overcome difficulties and challenges. And that, we know, is where the real learning happens. We're not trying to just create this smooth yellow brick road, although in truth the yellow brick road wasn't all that smooth, was it? But you know what I mean, what would it paint road where you're just going on your destination to the Emerald City, which is in Nirvana of knowledge. We actually want children to find these challenges as they go. And we're not sure what those challenges are yet. And those are authentic, which is why Rob has mentioned several times that word authentic. It's something that we're really passionate about hanging on to, which is why the task-based, topic-based approach isn't, because it's not authentic. You are going to make a gingerbread man with them again, because you're doing, you know, traditional tales. Well, that is lovely. And we all like to make a gingerbread man, of course. But why? What's the real intention behind that? What else could we do that could use the same skills? That could be all about, you know, using our mathematics skills and our literacy skills to write a recipe and our questioning and our, you know, all of the framework is there, still there. But what could we do? Something that's just more interesting and exciting. Yes. And I think the heart of the question you're asking is, you know, what is it? Why are we doing it? And the truth is because we really want the learning to be joyful. And it's only joyful when there's an element of surprise in there, really. Otherwise, that's lost, right? If we got up every day and had Groundhog Day, would be incredibly dull. And in fact, the movie itself demonstrated that. So what we don't want is Groundhog Day in education for children. They get up every day and now they're going to do the maths challenge, or they get up every day and now they're going to make a gingerbread man. I really want to challenge practitioners out there to go on a bit more of a risk-taking route, because I think you'll find you get the joy back into teaching and learning again.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, interestingly as well, that idea of no 2 days being the same and really sort of mixing it up and being surprised by learning, not knowing what's coming next. That's exciting for the children, but it's also exciting, I think, for the teachers and the practitioners. And it takes, as we were just saying, I think a special teacher or practitioner who engages with something which is like stepping off at almost, you know, that kind of, you know, stepping into midair in terms of the learning journey, not really knowing where you're going with it, but it being completely authentic because of that. Whereas when you know what the next step in the journey is, because you've written the topic and the project and you've written it down to the hilt, you know what's coming next. And so when a child asks a question, you, even though you might say, oh, I don't know, I wonder, they know that actually you know what's coming next. You see what I mean? It doesn't sound authentic. Even if you try to sound authentic in that moment, you don't. But when you genuinely don't know what this insect is that you found, you don't know the name of it, or you don't know that dinosaur name because you are completely on your own here and you just don't know. Children appreciate the authenticity of you saying, I don't know. I really don't know. I genuinely don't know. Let's find out. There's a difference that I think children, even as young as three, know the difference between an adult who says, oh, I don't know, let's find out, when they do know, and an adult who says, I genuinely don't know, let's find out, and who's really interested. There's a difference there, definitely. And I think your practice, to me, sounds like it's at the heart of that.
However amazing some of the projects that I've done as a teacher or that I've seen, I've never seen them done twice, because no cohort of children is the same as the last. Those interests were not the same. So however good that hotel project was, and there was a ready-made trip in there, all the risk assessments are pretty much done, but I've never seen them. It's not been done again, because it's not been the same inspiration to children again. because the children's ideas have changed. The life has moved on. The world is different now. You know, if they're going to be a project on Labubus at some point, you know, because that's an interest. And, you know, we've got to wait. We've got to ask the children and find out what they're interested in and find out what's going to be valuable to them when they ask the questions, when and what they show us they want to learn.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. We'd better start to wrap things up. I'm aware that actually you're busy people. I'm keeping you for ages. One final thing, and that is basically what's next. I'm intrigued to know, you know, obviously this isn't an end point. It never is it, in terms of developing a curriculum, developing a, you know, developing an approach. So where are you at with it and what comes next for you?
Good question. We think of it as an evolving curriculum, don't we, Rob? And I think we talk about this a lot because we are passionate about this. And this is what really lights our spark, is to use your words. We have spent some time as leaders, both middle leaders and senior leaders, observing and listening to and asking questions of our children, of our parents, trying to understand about making sure that we are on the front foot in terms of what we're offering to children here in our school. So we've got two big projects on our ring burner that we are launching this year, one of which is our new makerspace. Obviously, very much of the zeitgeist. Everybody's talking about AI and STEAM. So, of course, it's fairly obvious, I suppose, to many listeners that makerspace would be an obvious choice. But we've really intentionally evolved it as a project with our children in year one. And they have helped us design that space for their use and the use of younger children in the school. They've even made the sign outside. They've designed the space. We've got a big launch of the makerspace to parents and VIPs happening this month. And they are leading the entire. So this was a great opportunity. As Rob said, no two things the same, but we wanted to evolve a makerspace. We've got some ideas. We did some research on best practice of what an early years makerspace should look and feel like and why. And then the children have led that with us. So that's one of our bigger projects. Yeah. And the other one is about financial literacy. Again, quite a popular topic around the world. Young people getting to teenage and university age and not really knowing how to manage a bank account and understanding money and financial literacy. So we are doing an early years project. We're doing something quite groundbreaking actually here in China. And we're doing what we call our own Wellington Bank in the early years. And again, it's a pupil-led project with the support and guidance of teacher ambassadors to help them and parent experts. And we are going to open and develop and run our own Wellington Bank with a whole framework of learning behind that from some training that we got from a UK expert, actually, to help us to support children to really understand in an age-appropriate way money and how that is, how money and saving and investment really works. So in again, a role play. Role play is a real theme here of project-based learning, isn't it? Yeah. So our bank is going to be a permanent fixture of the school. And as children move through the school, the year one children, before they leave, will hand it over to the upcoming year one children, who will then also run the bank and help the younger children. So it's like
a really interesting project.
So that's what's next for us. And we're very excited. Maybe we'll come back in 6 months or a year and let you know how we've gotten on with those projects.
I would love that. It's really, really interesting stuff. Yeah, no, I love the way that you've kind of always got an eye on what might be next then. But also, interestingly, very much in a kind of a global sense, you know, not just about kind of, not just sort of keeping very, being quite sort of just focused in a blinkered way on just what you're doing within your school, but looking out beyond that and thinking, actually, well, what, you know, what do we need children to be able to learn beyond school? You know, what is that picture like, you know, when they leave school, when they go to university, when they manage their own money or any of those sorts of things, that actually it's about that bigger picture too, isn't it?
Yeah. And I will say one final thing about this world of AI, which we're all really trying to get our heads around, is that more than ever, we do believe in our school that really supporting the development of well-rounded, empathetic young humans is the future. So we never take our eye off that. However exciting and future forward and 21st century our curriculum becomes in terms of STEAM and literacy, financial literacy rather, we really do know that what underpins this is our personal, social and emotional development of our young humans, never mind young learners. And that's going to be ever more important as they take a journey, because the jobs they're going to be picking up on when they graduate university do not exist at the moment. So, you know, you've got to really think about preparing them for being humans and for actually continuing the most important part of humanity in this age of AI, I think.
Yes, which is a very good point at which to stop, I think. What a powerful message, really powerful. Charlotte and Rob, thank you so much for joining us. It's been really, really interesting, fascinating to chat to you. I'm sure lots of our listeners listening in will be really inspired by such a lot of what you've talked about in terms of your approaches, in terms of how you build in that bilingual nature into your practice, you know, the balancing act that you must do on a daily basis. You know, it's really, really interesting and really powerful, I think. And clearly, you know, the impact on your children, you know, what you talk about in terms of problem solving, what you talk about in terms of building those young learners, I think is really, really powerful stuff. So thank you so much for joining me. It's been brilliant to have you as a guest.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Andy.
So there you go. Thank you very much to Charlotte and Rob for joining us on the podcast this week. And of course, thank you to you people for listening along as well. Have a good week, everybody, and we will see you next time.